And now, live from Earth, it's the Enviro Show on WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Valley Free Radio, Northampton. Show tonight, Darth Chaney and the Great Migration. Something for everyone this evening. We return again to the plight of our four-legged relations, specifically those studied by UMass wildlife biologist Malik Matajan, who is with us here. And he did these studies in the Boma National Park and within that massive Southern Sudan animal migration recently featured in the New York Times. Also, it's an extended Darth Chaney segment tonight, given the recent revelations in the Washington Post and his latest machinations for the real evil empire. David Kruidsma phones in from the road, hopefully. That may or may not happen.
Well, we missed him in the last show.
Yeah, the ride for climate finds our guy from Amherst biking into the Bighorn Mountains out in Sheridan, Wyoming, Chaney's home state. Ooh, careful, David. He's armed and dangerous. Where's it? Yeah. Yes. And let's see. What else? I think it's time for we'll do the Enviro Show Echo Chamber later, but first it's time for Revenge of the Critters. Far away. Let's try that again. very loud. Spider invasion creeping out, Austrians, AP. This was a year ago, and in Vienna, Austria, an eight-legged invasion was giving some Austrians the creeps. The venomous yellow sack spider, whose painful bite can cause headache and nausea, had become the talk of the town since several people were bitten last summer. Reports of spider sightings dominated local media, triggering hundreds of calls to the Vienna poison hotline and prompting the government to issue a plea for calm. Quote, "The bites of the yellow sack spider are indeed painful, but not deadly," Health Minister Maria Rauch-Kallet said in a statement. "If you are bitten, please don't panic, and in case of discomfort, immediately contact a doctor." Underscoring the hysteria, 190 people who feared they might have been bitten went to the main hospital in the northwestern city of Linz. Only eight of them turned out to have the possible symptoms, doctors told Austrian state broadcaster ORF. All right, this Revenge of the Critters for this fine day. Let's hear from the crickets. Do we have let's listen to what it sounds like at night in the valley these days for a few minutes. Time for the Environment Show, Echo Chamber. Oh, you know, we never introduced
ourselves. I'm Glenn Ayers.
I'm Theo. And Gene is away off to California.
You're listening to the Environment Show.
On Valley Radio. And it's time for the Environment Show Echo Chamber segment.
The Echo Chamber segment.
From the New York Times, a must read op-ed by Al Gore in the Sunday, July 1st edition. Moving Beyond Kyoto. Too long a read for here, except for a few highlights, but we've linked to it on our blog. And if you'll go to Google and just Google in Enviro Show, or go to MySpace. We're on MySpace now.
We are.
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
So, Big Al says, "We, the human species, have arrived at a moment of decision. It is unprecedented and even laughable for us to imagine that we could actually make a conscious choice as a species, but that is nevertheless the challenge that is before us. Our home, Earth, is in danger. What is at risk of being destroyed is not the planet itself, but the conditions that have made it hospitable for human beings and other creatures, we might add. Without realizing the consequences of our actions, we have begun to put so much carbon dioxide into the thin shell of air surrounding our world that we have literally changed the heat balance between Earth and the Sun. If we don't stop doing this pretty quickly, the average temperature will increase to levels humans have never known and put an end to the favorable climate balance on which our civilization depends." And it goes on. So I really suggest you go to the blog and read this whole piece because it's an excellent op-ed. And of course, this was just the week before last weekend's live Earth concerts that Gore helped organize, of course, was a big part of. That was a very important moment. So moving on, we did that. Business prevails in environmental case, and this was also in the New York Times. Washington, the Supreme Court sided with developers and the Bush administration Monday.
Was it 5-4?
A dispute with environmentalists over protecting endangered species. And if you recall, our last show was all about endangered species. The court ruled 5-4 for the home builders and the Environmental Protection Agency in a case that involved the intersection of two environmental laws, the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. Justice Samuel Alito, new to the court, writing for the conservative majority, said that the Endangered Species Law takes a back seat to the Clean Water Law when it comes to EPA handling authority to a state to issue water pollution permits. Developers often need such permits before they can begin building. A federal appeals court had said that EPA did not do enough to ensure the endangered species would not be harmed if the state took over the permit. Environmental groups, backed by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, said the administration position would, in essence, gut a key provision of the endangered species law. The act prohibits federal agency action that will jeopardize a species and calls for consultation between federal agencies. Cases are National Association of Home Builders versus Defenders of Wildlife. EPA versus Defenders of Wildlife as well.
This was a case, I think it was it Arizona? Does it say?
It does not say.
Yeah, it was a case where the state got primacy and decided that they no longer needed to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service on endangered species. And the big issue is that the Bush administration is in the process now of turning over the program in Alaska to the state, so that for the entire state of Alaska, they'll no longer need to do consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service. So that would have severe implications for many species in Alaska.
So the Bush regime court strikes again.
Yes.
Onward. More bad news. Poachers kill one of the last two white rhinos in Zambia. This is from the French press agency. Poachers have shot the last two white rhinos in Zambia, killing one and wounding the other in a night operation at the Mosi Oatunya National Park in Livingston, an official said yesterday. The shooting of the two endangered animals is in a heavily guarded zoological park near Victoria Falls in Zambia's tourist resort town of Livingston took place last week, which would now be, this dated 6/12/07, so several weeks ago. Quote, I can confirm that one of the white rhinos was shot dead by suspected poachers. The other one was wounded and is undergoing treatment, said Maureen Mwapi, spokesperson of the Zambia Wildlife Authority, which would be investigating the shooting. The dead female rhino's horn was apparently removed. And we've talked about this on this show before, how the rhino horns in some Asian countries are considered aphrodisiacs and go for phenomenal amounts of money, leading them open to poachers who barely have anything to eat most of the time. Zambia's white rhinos are killed by poachers, but the government managed to acquire six from South Africa in 93. Of which the injured male is the last to survive. So the rhinos have been in big crisis for many years. I have some other rhino facts, but we're going to have to move on. Hopefully David will be calling in soon from Wyoming. But let's see. Oh, yeah, on the blog, check out, we have an action link for polar bears. Believe it or not, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are giving trophy hunts for polar bears.
Really?
Give us a break. Can you believe that?
While they last. Get them while they last.
Get them while they last. So if you go
get
to
them while they're hot, I guess you could say.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you go to our blog, you know, enviroshow.blogspot.com, or just Google it in, you can go to that action link and try to get U.S. Fish and Wildlife to get real. Okay. Some good news from the Amherst Bulletin.
We need to have a little good news today.
Yes, yeah. We have to do that. I found this in last week's bulletin. Colleges town making strides to limit energy consumption. And I'm not even going to attempt to go through this whole thing, but the little sidebar says the University of Massachusetts has reduced its energy consumption by 20% through the conservation measures through conservation measures such as efficient lighting, insulation in dormitory roofs, and new water-saving toilets, air conditioning systems. The campus spent $43 million on the improvements, and the cost is projected to be recovered over 10 years through the money saved by electricity. Next year, a new $100 million power plant west of the Mullen Center is scheduled to switch on. It's burned mostly natural gas. Mostly. Why does it say mostly?
I think they're switching from coal and to natural gas.
Yeah, and be more efficient than the old plant, which burns mostly coal, notorious for being dirty and emitting greenhouse gases. The town of Amherst also invested in energy conservation. It has replaced traffic signals with low-power models, cut wattage on street lamps, bought hybrid vehicles, and converted public work trucks to run on biodiesel. Amherst College has brought hybrid vehicles and converted heavy equipment to diesel. All new and renovated buildings are designed with automated temperature controls, and new power plant will convert waste heat into usable thermal energy starting this winter. The hockey rink has low-energy lights and foil liner in the ceiling to cut refrigeration costs. And this year, the residents of college president Tony Marks will get solar hot water panels. And Hampshire College has converted buildings from electric heat to gas and hot water and is upgrading its lighting to be efficient. And then they have another sidebar with the top 10 tips on how to conserve on energy. And just briefly, I'll go through a few of them. Of course, turn off the lights when leaving the room. If you have an air conditioner, set your thermostat a little higher this summer, and next winter, set your furnace a little lower. Get a car that averages 35 miles per gallon. I'd say get one that gets more if you can find one. When buying new appliances, invest in a little extra to buy an energy-efficient one. Consolidate your driving. In other words, get your errands together. Install compact fluorescent light bulbs. And when waiting for someone in the car, turn off the engine. I did that at your house just today.
Yeah, so I was a good boy. Yep.
Shop at Amherst stores and buy food at the farmer's market. Better yet, grow your own. Use cold water for washing. And number 10, make sure you have enough insulation in your home. It's all pretty common sense stuff, but it's good to keep repeating it anyway. And the final thing is our roving reporter, Tom Nielsen.
Is roving.
Reports. He's roving out in the heartlands. He reports from the heartlands, and the lakes of Wisconsin are drying up, is what he says. One lake, they changed the name of to Mud Lake. Maybe Texas could send up some surplus rain.
Yeah.
Oh, is this David? I hope so. While Glenn is setting this up, I will continue to rattle on. And we'll get to the Darth Chaney theme and all that business shortly. But first, I think we have David Kruzma on the line.
Hello?
David, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Great. You're out where? In the Bighorn Mountains?
Yeah, I'm perhaps about 70,000 feet here in the Bighorn Mountains. And I found a little patch of road with cell reception and calling in.
Could you tell us, the listeners that didn't hear you the last time you called in, just briefly, what you guys are doing and the kind of reception you're getting out there in Dick Cheney country in Wyoming?
Well, it's very interesting. Again, what I'm doing is I'm biking across the country to encourage action on global warming. You can visit our website at rideforclimate.com. And I'm a climate scientist. That's my background. And it's interesting. I mean, we biked through the part of the country where a majority of our coal energy comes from. There's 85 coal trains a day that come out of this area. And we were not able to set up a talk there at all. But we did find a number of other places. People are very concerned about, you know, wildlife issues here in Wyoming, issues about wildfires, who are concerned about global warming here. But they are definitely a minority.
I spent some time out there in Wyoming as a Cheney hater when I was younger, and mm-hmm. we drove around the eastern part of the state where there are extensive strip mines where they mine bentonite clay. I don't know if you rode your bike through that area, mm-hmm. but a lot of those areas have just been abandoned. But then you get into the coal areas where they're they're mining really huge areas, and those areas are really devastated out there. And you know, a lot of people talk about burning coal and what it does to climate because of the carbon dioxide and the greenhouse gases, but what mining coal does to the planet itself, just the incredible devastation.
I mean, you can definitely make the argument, you know, that it you look at coal communities, and it's hard to say even if the coal gives them a lot of wealth, that it helps the communities substantially. Another really interesting thing about Crossing Wyoming for us has been visiting ranches. We stayed at one ranch, and it's, you know, a very different lifestyle than we have on the coast. And you can see why a lot of farmers, a lot of ranchers, are opposed to a lot of global warming issues, because they're much more reliant on fossil fuels than, you know, those of us living in cities or on the coasts. And so it really brings up a big issue. If we're going to solve this problem, you know, we need to do it in a way such that you know, people who are really reliant on it right now are not overly burdened.
David, I noticed that on the Live Earth page the day after the performance, all over the world, that they had a link to your site.
You bet it did.
So you're getting a lot of traffic?
We've been doing very well on traffic. Yeah, sometimes we have to make sure our site doesn't crash, in fact. But yeah, we're doing very well. You know, what we're most excited about, though, is how well we're doing with local media.
Right.
You know, here in Sheridan, which is still in this very coal-producing basin, we had a half-hour radio interview where the person was able to ask us tough questions, which were very good, and we hope people heard our responses, you know, pointing out that it's really solid science that the Earth is warming, and there really are, because of the carbon dioxide we're putting in the atmosphere, and there really are good arguments against that. And it's at the point where we have to act on it.
Well, you guys are excellent. And I'm glad you're out of the flatlands now and into the mountains, get a little cooler.
Yeah, let me tell you where I am really happy to be up in the mountains today.
I'll bet.
It is good and cool, but it's been some hot days.
All right. Well, we got Malik Mardajan from the UMass Wildlife here that we're going to be interviewing shortly, so we don't want to keep him waiting. Thanks so
Excellent.
Much for calling in, David, and will you be calling us in 2 weeks?
Yeah, I'll give it a try, and be sure again, you know, you can check us out online at rideforclimate.com. We're Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming.
You bet, and we'll link to your site on our blog, too.
Keep on
happy trails.
Keep on trucking.
Thanks so much.
Adios.
Bye.
Great.
All right.
Now, am I supposed to do something here?
Now we can dive right into the interview.
All right, Darth Chaney, we're just going to have to do this briefly.
Okay.
Yes. There's the theme, Glenn. Much longer until Darth Chaney, the Boy Emperor, and their ilk are banished.
Go ahead, do your part first. I'll find the
do my part.
Timer. Yeah.
All right. Well, Darth and his Death Star on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue are taking some fire lately from the rebel forces at the Washington Post. Finally, let's have a look at just a brief excerpt of this week-long series. This one focusing on Darth's assault on planet Earth, and it's. The vice president has intervened in many cases to undercut long-standing environmental rules for the benefit of business. In Oregon, a battleground state, the Bush and Cheney ticket had lost by less than half of 1%. Drought-stricken farmers and ranchers were about to be cut off from irrigation water that kept their cropland and pastures green. Federal biologists said the Endangered Species Act left the government no choice. The survival of two imperiled species of fish was at stake. Law and science seemed to be on the side of the fish for a change, and then the Veep stepped in because of Cheney's intervention. Government reversed itself and let the water flow to save the 2002 growing season, declaring that there was no threat to the fish. What followed was the largest fish kill in the West ever seen, with tens of thousands of salmon rotting on the banks of the Klamath River. Characteristically, Cheney left no tracks. The vice president also pushed to make Nevada's Yucca Mountain the nation's repository for nuclear and radioactive waste.
Yeah, they don't want it, though.
Aide said, a victory for the nuclear power industry over those longstanding safety concerns, and his office was a powerful force behind the White House decision to rewrite the Clinton-era land protection measure that put nearly a third of the national forests off limit to logging, mining, and most development, former Cheney staff members said. Cheney made his environmental views clear in public, but with some notable exceptions, he generally has preferred to operate with stealth, aided by loyalists who owe him their careers.
So the momentum's starting to build for the impeached Cheney.
Yes.
Which is great. So I'm going to do the countdown timer here and say that instead of, you know, all we have left are so many days to survive the regime, let's turn it around and say this is an opportunity we have here. Let's not pass this by. Let's think positively. Here on the Enviro Show, we're counting down the days until impeachment. And so we have 559
wow.
days, 6 hours, 15 minutes, and 20 seconds left. And let's start the impeachment process here.
All right.
Impeach Cheney first.
I don't have it. Yes, I have. What do I have here? Something like, yes, a little after.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to skip this Libby thing.
Yep. And let's skip the song we're going to play
yeah.
right now. We'll do it afterwards.
We're blowing a lot of stuff off here
yeah.
so we can get to this
let's
interview.
Let's just get right into the interview.
All right. If you folks remember the last time we were on, we talked about this piece in the New York Times.
No, that was 2 shows ago.
Was it 2 shows ago?
Yeah. Yeah, you were on
really?
Vacation the last show.
Oh, that's right. You did solo.
Yeah.
Glad that's behind you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Science Times, New York Times Science Edition, Tuesday, June 12th, the headline was "In Sudan, an Animal Migration to Rival the Serengeti." And when you read into it, you find out that our very own UMass wildlife biologist was involved in it. I'm trying to find the very quote in here, but of course I don't have it underlined, so so I'm blowing it. Anyway, joining us now is Malik Matajan, UMass wildlife biologist who studied in the Bowman National Park and was one of the people that discovered this massive animal migration. Welcome.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell the listeners, if you would, briefly what you found out in your studies at the Bowman National Park and with this southern Sudan animal migration.
Well, actually, it's not a first-hand discovery because those animals have been there and we've been working with them for long. We went there to do survey, and it's the first survey in 25 years. The last time ever people went and did aerial survey there, it was 1982. And we repeated the same methodology at one of the same season that those people did this 25 years ago. And
why so long?
Well, there has been a civil war in Sudan since...
Because of the civil war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since 1983.
Yeah.
Which I just ended in 2005. With the peace agreement between South and North.
I see. Mm. And during that time period, was the wildlife affected by the war?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. A lot of times, wildlife takes a big hit from civil unrest like that. But what's the good news there? There must be good news. What were the results of the survey?
Well, it is a mix. There is good news that we found some species are thriving in a good condition, like the migration of white eared cob, the tiang, and the mangala gazelle. But also there are bad news that some species also decline terribly, and others we could not see them.
So the change since, when was it?
Yeah, since 1983 to 2007, you can say there is mixed that some species money to do well, some species got affected so much.
Yeah, and what was the basic difference? Like, why were some species doing better than others?
Well, it depends on the nature of species and also where the conflict concentrated and the human movements.
What areas did better? More remote areas?
Yeah, the remote areas, and even locally there is known as no man's land.
No man's land.
Yeah, these are the areas where there was intensified fighting and everybody vacated it.
Yeah. Yeah, in this country we have the kind of wilderness areas or preserves, and a lot of people argue that the bigger the areas are, the better off the wildlife will be, just because they'll be more isolated in, you know, as far away from population as they can be, and some kind of a social, you know, strife situation or civil war, that certainly would come into play. The farther away animals can be, maybe the better off they'd be. What were some of the other things? I think I read in the article that there was an area that was kind of impenetrable because it was a wet area or a wetland kind of area, a swamp, something like that.
Yeah, there is a swamp which is being said to be the largest wetland in Africa or in the world.
Wow.
It's a flatland where the Nile comes and the water will just spread on, coupled with water from rains, and it formed that, and locally known as the Soot. Soot in local language then means barrier.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so you can't go through there with cars or something?
No, you could easily get lost there.
Yeah. And so that became a refuge for a lot of animals?
It has been a refuge for a long time.
Mm.
And that Soot also was under threat by construction of what was known as Jungle Canal, which was partially dug, but when the war started, it stopped. It was meant to drain that wetland.
Wow.
So that the water will go to Egypt and so on. Upper areas, yeah.
It says here in the Times piece that you retraced the path of the last aerial surveys before the war, and the white-eared cob, is it? Were joined by hundreds of thousands of gazelles and tiang, a species of antelope. They formed a gigantic column that stretched 30 miles across and 50 miles long. What was it like to fly over? Were you flying over that?
Yeah, we flew over that area.
What was that like to see something like that?
It's something amazing, yes.
I can't imagine what that is.
Yeah. I mean, you hear the stories of the passenger pigeons in this country,
yeah, right,
you know, that darken the skies, right, for 5 days, one flock flying over. And you know, that's just incomprehensible. But that's a huge herd right there. I guess we had those kinds of things on the plains in this country, you know, back before all the buffalo were shot.
So Dr. Fay, who you work with, says that his personal feeling is it's the biggest migration on Earth. You would agree?
Well, it is a suggestion and needs some more work to be done over the next 3-4 years. Then people will come to a real conclusion.
Yeah.
But what we are seeing, the speed of the aircraft and the speed of the movements of animals, we believe that we have missed some herds in between the transects. And also, the group size, we see that huge groups and more congested, and the observers could not count each and every one. So we believe also there is a big missing. So we want to improve the methodology we use, photography means, rather than just counting, direct counting by eyes, and we'll see the difference. And until this is done and repeated 2-3 times, we will come to a conclusion whether this suggestion is true or not.
And this is work that you're doing toward your PhD?
Yes, it's part of
your PhD.
Yeah.
And are you working with any international groups on this project?
Yeah, the National Geographic Society and
National Wildlife Geographic.
And Wildlife Conservation Society.
Wow. Yeah.
And the government of Southern Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
And Boma Wildlife Training Center, where I work before I came to UMass.
And are you going back when you're done with your PhD?
Yes.
Yes, that's great. Of course. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know I went to a kind of an international college in Colorado, where a lot of the students came from, especially the arid areas in the Middle East and Africa. And so many of them stayed here in the States. And, you know, we just of course, I was born here, and so, you know, I'm not going to probably go anywhere, but I felt like so many students were coming to this country and staying here, and it was a real loss for their own people. It was a brain drain on their communities. And it's great to hear that, you know, you come here, learn something, and take it back there and try to teach the people conservation in their own country, because when people love their own land, they'll do things to save it.
I think this is the only question that I got from immigration official, visa officials at the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi when I went for my visa. They were telling me, convince me, are you going to go back? I told him, well, when I did my first degree in Sudan and I went to England, University of Kent, where I did my master's there, when I finished, I came back to Southern Sudan and I started this work, which is now continuing and getting bigger and bigger, and many people are coming into it. So if you compare London and U.S., they're all the same. If I cannot stick in the U.K., why should I come and stick in the U.S.?
Yeah.
And now when I went back from U.K. and started this work, I got a bigger position, which I will not get it here. So if I remained there, I would have lost just in between. So definitely I'm going back. And right now, I'm studying here, and my project is there in Sudan, and I have to travel frequently
back and forth. Yeah, yep.
Yeah.
And are you using some remote sensing techniques besides flying over? Like, is the whole project in a GIS kind of database that you're putting things into, kind of a spatial database? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we are combining it, the GIS remote sensing, and also we are using a new technique, that NDVI, where we estimate abundance of animal in relation to their resources, green vegetation and water and other things.
And we
are planning to put collars on them,
to track
GPS collars to track them, and the data will be simulated in also this.
So this is really state of the art research. It's amazing.
So how are you very concerned about the integrity of the habitat and the migration corridors? Here in the closing part of the article, it says it will also be necessary to balance the conservation of wildlife with the economic recovery from the war. This Dr. Elkin, who's quoted here, said you have oil exploration in the northern part of the Sud, and already and oil permits have been handed out throughout most of the migratory corridor for the animals. The government is rebuilding roads and schools, and people are returning to their farms, places hopping, it says. So does this concern you in that poaching might move into the area, or the migration might be affected by development of some sort?
Yeah, that is one of the major questions we want to answer in our study, or my study. The area of these three migrations, it is in the southern part of Jonglei State, is all covered within Block 5 for the oil concession. So most of the areas have been actually been given out as concession areas. And definitely the animals will get affected in one way or the other. So that's why we are putting those objectives of tracking the animals, counting them, looking at the habitats and all these things, so that we will see and do some check and balances between development needs and the needs for the environment. And also, we don't forget that Southern Sudan is one of the most underdeveloped or undeveloped areas in the world. And we have gone through two successive wars since 1955 to 1972, then 10 years of peace, then from 1983 to 2005, this another 22 years of war. And just recently a government has been formed and is still being doing some rehabilitation here and there and building itself. And when you look at all this, there is a great need for oil revenue to kick off the development in the area. So now you have a need for oil, need for the money from the oil, and also there is a need for keeping habitat for wildlife and environment. So these are two factors pointing on the area.
How much longer will you be studying this project? I mean, maybe for the rest of your life, but until you get your PhD.
Well, for my PhD, I'm supposed to be doing the fieldwork for 3 years and do the write-up and other things.
And what year are you in now?
I'm now in my second year.
Second year.
But just about to start the fieldwork, but has not yet started because we're still looking for fun. So up to now, we have not gotten the callers, we've not gotten any other things other than this single area survey, and we're supposed to be repeating it over 3 seasons.
And so you're working with other groups to get the funding for the project?
Yeah, my professors, they're helping me, and we have done one proposal in for Wildlife Conservation Society, and we're working for the second one. We hope to place it to National Geographic Society or any other group who are willing to help.
And is there going to be an article on this in National Geographic, or was there already?
I think it's already there because the time when we were doing the survey, one of their photographers came there, and we spent 1 week flying around interviewing people, and so they're going to have to put one article.
That's it's amazing. I think one area that I would, I'm not a world traveler, but I've always thought of going to the rainforests, and some kind of wildlife area like this would be probably, I don't want to say the last chance on Earth to see something like this, but it's almost what we're getting to at this point. So, I could be an eco-terrorist. I mean, an eco-tourist. An eco-tourist. And So, I guess my kind of final thought or question here is, what language do you speak in Southern Sudan?
Me or the people?
Well,
because in Southern Sudan there is 69 languages.
69 languages,
In addition to English and Arabic. But every ethnic group or every what they call tribes or nationality has their own language.
Has their own language. What do you speak?
Yeah, I speak number of them.
Number of them, yeah. See, you know, I'm bringing this up because, in general, Americans are pathetic when it comes to speaking languages. I mean, it's embarrassing. But, we're on the web, we're on the internet, and if you wanted to say anything in your native tongue to anyone back there who may be listening, you're certainly welcome to say hello to anybody you want to. We're traveling around the world on the internet. And also from my experience in talking with other people, especially people I went to school with, listening to other languages sometimes just gives you a totally different perspective on things. So would you care to say anything to anyone?
So Malik, if people want to learn more about the Boma National Park and this amazing animal migration, where do they turn to? Does your department have a website, or is there publications that, besides this piece in the Times, that they can turn to?
Yeah, there is a website, and in the department there, students are linked to major website of their major professors. So my project is attached to website of my major professor, who is Todd Fuller.
Todd Fuller, yeah. So, what's the website?
Is when you go to, it is part of Natural Resources Department, Natural Resources Conservation. So, when you go to www.umass.edu, you scroll to Natural Resources Conservation, then you go to faculty. Get down to name of Todd Fuller, you click, then his is under the profile, you'll find his students, you find my...
And you're on there.
Yeah.
Okay, so people that wanted to go find out some more.
Is this something we can link to on the blog?
Yeah, we can put a link to it on our blog.
Great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming in, and good luck with your work.
I just want to say, it's obvious this is really important work. It's great that you're doing it.
Really?
And, I really hope you get the funding to put it through and for the next 3 years and get your PhD out of it and go back there and save some wildlife and save some lands in your country and educate the people. That's great. Great work.
Yeah, thank you. Definitely will go back because beside my studies, I also work for a training center there, and we are training a huge number of former rebels who are assigned to do wildlife rangers.
Oh, that's great.
So we are training them from rebel setting, military setting to conservationists.
That's great.
Yeah.
Excellent. Very, very nice to meet you.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you for your time also.
Good luck. Okay, moving on. I don't know whether we ought to put some of that music we blew off or whether we should go right into the bus stop billboard.
Oh, no, we got some time for a song. What?
You want to? I had that song picked out for The Boy Emperor.
Oh, yeah.
What Does W Stand For by John Lilly from Hail to the Thieves. I thought we should play something like this after the Scooter Libby sentence commute.
All right. Run now?
Ah.
All right.
Let's go for it. Goes out to the Boy Emperor, King George, and Darth Shaney is his sidekick, or boss, or whatever. And we move on to the bus stop billboard. We have a lot of things happening here. Friday, July 13th at 6 p.m., Ride for the Planet. Meet at Pulaski Park for a 20-mile group ride organized by Sue Bartone and Sustainable Energy East Hampton and Mary Cerez from No Exit 19. It says they hope to do this weekly and won't let the weather stop them. But if it's raining too much, they'll meet at the Haymarket to talk about a plan for the next ride. And we want to raise awareness about bikes, transportation, global warming, peak oil, and relocalization. And then also, we have a lot of stuff on Friday, July 13th, 7 p.m., Bill McGibbon, Deep Economy and the Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future at Odyssey Books in the Village Commons in South Hadley. For info, call 413-534-7307 or 800-540-7307. And also Friday, right here in Florence, Friday, July 13th, 7 to 9 p.m., Beaver Fever Hike at Fitzgerald Lake and North Farms Road, Florence. Call the Broad Brook Coalition, 413-586-4364. And then Wednesday, July 11th, and Friday, July 13th, 9 a.m. at the Windham County Courthouse in Newfane, Vermont, Entergy will be presenting its findings as the effects of temperature increase in the Connecticut River. Attend and support our friends at CAN and NECNP. Contact Evan Mulholland for more legal info. EvanMulholland@yahoo.com. And the environmental court contact is 802-828-1660. Thursday, July 12th, 7 p.m., the State Department of Public Utilities is holding a public hearing in Russell on the transmission line corridors for the proposed Russell biomass plant. The corridors will either run through rare and priority species habitat in the Tekoa and Grace Robson State Wildlife Sanctuaries or through neighborhoods in Russell and Westfield. Hearing at the Russell Elementary School on Highland Avenue. Call 862-0037 for info. Saturday, July 14th, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., the Holly Bog Walk. Come visit this pristine peatland jointly owned by the Nature Conservancy and five colleges. During midsummer, we should see blooming orchids such as pink grass and fringed orchid, all three native insectivorous plants. Did I say that right?
Insectivorous.
Insectivorous. And many members of the Heath family that make the bog their home. This one costs bucks, 10 bucks, 15 bucks if you're not a member. Registration phone 413-584-3009. And then July 17th, Springfield Area Sustainable Energy Association upcoming meeting, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Springfield Tech Community College, Building 17, Room 515. Call for volunteers for the Green Buildings Open House. Come get involved. For information, 413-734-1456, extension 209. Remember, all this stuff is on the blog. Go to enviroshow.blogspot.com or just Google in EnviroShow. Sunday, July 22nd, noon to 2 p.m., Green and Nuclear Free, a community gathering in favor of energy efficiency, renewable energy, and closing Vermont Yankee.
Shut it down.
Brattleboro Town Common, Park Place between Linden Streets and Putney Road, Brattleboro. Music by Charlie King and Derek Jordan. And a nonviolent civil disobedience action at 2 p.m. A group of people will carpool from the Common to Vermont Yankee to do an act of nonviolent civil disobedience. Others will come to witness and support. Co-sponsored by Citizens Awareness Network, Vermont Yankee Decommissioning Alliance, New England Coalition for Nuclear Pollution, on Nuclear Pollution, Nuclear Free Vermont. Information, www.nukebusters.org, or call 413-339-5781 or 802-254-2531. Yes. All right, we're at 6:54 now.
Got 2 minutes.
We got a few minutes.
Two.
What are we going to have next week? We're hoping to have Robert F. Kennedy Jr. call in and tell us about his thoughts on Cape Wind.
Yeah, the Cape Bag of Wind show.
The Cape Bag of Wind show. So hopefully that'll be happening in 2 weeks. Of course, next week at this time, our sister show, Farm to Fork, will be on.
Yeah. And coming up in August, we're going to have our anniversary show and fundraiser.
That's right. Our show in, I think, late August will be the last day of the fun drive and our birthday party.
Yeah.
Our second.
Is that the second show
Our
in
second
August?
Second birthday party, isn't it?
The second show in August.
I believe so.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so, and we're going to have prizes and premiums and all kinds of exciting things.
Yes.
Let's see, coming up next after our show is the
Hilltown Family Variety Show.
Yeah. And
you know what? What I got in the mail?
What's that?
I got a disc from Colleen Catow.
Oh.
Yes. Remember we played her.
Yeah, we did. We played
a
tune
back.
Yep.
Now she's got a new album out, Inhabited Woman, and I like this one, We Will Rise. So maybe we'll go out with that. Check out her website, by the way. It's Colleen Catow, spelled ColleenKatau.com. And, of course, Colleen's on our web, on our blog, excuse me, as well. And we're also on MySpace now.
All right.
Check
so
it out.
We're out of here.
Yes,
I'm Glenn Ayers saying,
Dio, say
listen to your mother.
Listen to your mother.
All right. See you in 2 weeks. To conquer all evil, make a pact with the earth, and this bounty beauty is everywhere possible, with love and tenderness. All around people doing some good things with their there.